This week, the true story of Thanksgiving. Friendly meal, political espionage, political posturing, mythology, or all of the above. This week, we're going to take a hard look using the Masonic tenet of truth to look at the unfiltered and raw story of Thanksgiving. The Wampanoags versus Manifest Destiny. Then, after a serious education, we'll take a lighthearted approach to a special tarot card draw. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 571. Want to give a shout out to all of our supporters of the show, our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for making this show possible week after week, month after month, year after year. We only go dark 2 times a year, with a rare exception. And since July of 2011, we've been bringing this show to you every single week. If you want to learn more about how you can assist the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. There'll be links in the show notes as well. In the news, I want to go ahead and give a huge thanks to Worshipful Brother David Truax for being behind the Double Eagle Con event, the Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite Northern Masonic Jurisdiction Valley of Chicago education event that we started last year. It was the concept of Brother Truax to do this. He contacted a bunch of people, got us all involved, and we made this conference happen last year. We had quite a number of speakers last year. Our survey results after the fact said that maybe we had too many speakers, so we wound it down a little bit. We had 5 great speakers this year, to include Charbel Fahad, Andy Albright, Scott Duvall, Robert Marshall, and Mark Driesenstock, all who flew out from various locations in the United States to shed some light for us. And it was a great event. If you want to see some pictures from that event, please head on over to the Facebook page for the Valley of Chicago Scottish Rite. Go ahead and give it a like and a follow if you want to see more of what's going on there. Really a great time. Lots of information was dispersed. Light was spread, just like cement. It was awesome. I also want to say thank you to everybody who reached out and wished well. My mom, who is doing a little bit better day by day. Things are getting a little bit better, and we'll see where things end up. But as always, things are a little bit tougher around the holiday times and things. So I just wanted to let you all know it really did mean a lot to me, those of you who did reach out or leave comments and things. Much appreciated. It was very heartwarming to read them. This being the week before Thanksgiving, I wanted to read some really cool stuff on Thanksgiving. As we all know in Freemasonry, we are at a search for truth, and what we're really looking for is real truth. Now, truth doesn't come from any one perspective. It comes from what we call an objective lens that we can see the happenings from various viewpoints. And then, if you wanted to think about this in a data kind of way, you could rank those viewpoints and put them all together and find the median or the mean or the average experience to paint a much more equitable picture of what was going on. Now, as we all grew up, it was very interesting to me to hear about how the Pilgrims and the Native Americans came together and didn't fight or kill each other and got together and shared what could only be described as, this kind of frontier feast. And that was really cool growing up, and you used to color the turkeys and do all these things. And then as you grow up, you learn a little bit more about the colonialism that was happening and the massacre of First Nations people and all of these things. And things start to feel a little bit inequitable. And then as you continue to learn and you continue to study these things, you start to dial back the hate that you had for your own colonial ancestors for what had happened in the New World. But it is so very important to remember the great injustice that was there and that had happened. And preparing for this particular show, I thought to myself, I wanted to read something that would be heartwarming And so, of course, I get onto Google and I type in Freemasonry and Thanksgiving. And the number one result is an article for the Midnight Freemasons called The Real First Thanksgiving. And I clicked on it and it was a broken link. And then I remembered that the article in question may have been taken down due to some dissonance. So, as we've done from time to time, I pulled articles that came from other academic sources that we can trust. Perhaps one of the more reputable websites that you can find some very good information from is the Smithsonian's website. Now, the Smithsonian, if those of you who don't know, it was actually founded from the trust of Brother Smithson, a Freemason, who did stipulate that the money he left behind was to fund what would become the Smithsonian, and that it would always be free admission. And it has maintained this. And after I read the article, I thought, man, I just don't know if that's going to hit home with our listeners across the board. Is there another article that says the same thing, but maybe softer? And I really could not find one. And then I was reminded of the Masons' search for real truth, for equity, and all of these things. I want to read this to you. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. I'm just going to read it as it comes across. And I hope that by the end of the article, we have a new appreciation for the holiday and exactly what it stands for today. Because we do have the power to reinvent, to repurpose, and to make things right. And so let's keep that in mind as we check this article out, called The Myths of the Thanksgiving Story and the Lasting Damage They Imbue. In truth, massacres, disease, and American Indian tribal politics are what shaped the Pilgrim Indian Alliance at the root of the holiday. First published, again, on the SmithsonianMagazine.com. Back in November of 2019. In Thanksgiving pageants held at schools across the United States, children don headdresses, colored with craft store feathers, and share tables with classmates wearing black construction paper hats. It's a tradition that pulls on a history passed down through the generations of what happened in Plymouth. Local Native Americans welcomed the courageous, pioneering pilgrims to a celebratory feast. But as David Silverman writes in his new book, This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving, much of that story is a myth riddled with historical inaccuracies. Beyond that, Silverman argues that the telling and retelling of these falsehoods is deeply harmful to the Wampanoag Indians, whose lives and society were forever damaged after the English arrived in Plymouth. Silverman's book focuses on the Wampanoags. When the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth in 1620, the Sachem, or the chief, Usamaquin, offered the new arrivals an entente, primarily as a way to protect the Wampanoags against their rivals, the Narragansetts. For 50 years, the alliance was tested by colonial land expansion, the spread of disease, and the exploitation of resources at the Wampanoag land. Then tensions ignited into war. Known as King Philip's War, or the Great Narragansett War, the conflict devastated the Wampanoags and forever shifted the balance of power in favor of European arrivals. Wampanoags today remember the Pilgrims' entry into the homeland as a day of deep mourning rather than a moment of giving thanks. We spoke with Silverman, a history professor at George Washington University, about his research and the argument he makes in his book. How did you become interested in this story? I've had a great many conversations with the Wampanoag people in which they talk about how burdensome Thanksgiving is for them, particularly for their kids. Wampanoag adults have memories of being a kid during Thanksgiving season, sitting in school, feeling invisible and having to wade through the nonsense that teachers were shoveling their way. They felt like their people's history, as they understood it, was being misrepresented. They felt that not only their classes, but society in general was making light of historical trauma which weighs around their neck like a millstone. Those stories really resonated with me. What is the Thanksgiving myth? The myth is that friendly Indians, unidentified by tribe, welcome the pilgrims to America, teach them how to live on this new place, sit down to dinner with them, and then disappear. They hand off America to white people so they can create a great nation dedicated to liberty, opportunity, and Christianity for the rest of the world to profit. That's the story. It's about native people conceding to colonialism. It's bloodless and, in many ways, an extension of the ideology of Manifest Destiny. What are the most poignant inaccuracies in the story? One is that history doesn't begin for native people until Europeans arrive. People had been in the Americas for at least 12,000 years, and according to some native traditions, since the beginning of time. And having history start with the English is a way of dismissing all that. The second is that the arrival of the Mayflower is some kind of first contact episode. It's not. Wampanoags had a century of contact with Europeans. It was bloody, and it involved slave raiding by Europeans. At least two, and maybe more Wampanoags when the Pilgrims arrived spoke English and had already been to Europe and back and knew the very organizers of the Pilgrims' venture. Most poignantly, using a shared dinner as a symbol for colonialism really has it backward. No question about it, Wampanoag leader Usamaquin reached out to the English at Plymouth and wanted an alliance with them, but it's not because he was innately friendly. It's because his people have been decimated by an epidemic disease. And Usamaquin sees the English as an opportunity to fend off his tribal rebels. That's not the stuff of Thanksgiving pageants. The Thanksgiving myth doesn't address the deterioration of this relationship, culminating in one of the most horrific colonial Indian wars on record, King Philip's War, and also doesn't address the Wampanoag's survival and adaptation over the centuries, which is why they're still here, despite the odds. How did the Great Dinner become the focal point of the modern Thanksgiving holiday? For quite a long time, English people had been celebrating Thanksgiving that didn't involve feasting. They involved fasting and prayer and supplication to God. In 1769, a group of Pilgrim descendants who lived in Plymouth felt like their cultural authority was slipping away as New England became less relevant within the colonies and the early Republic, and wanted to boost tourism. So they started to plant the seeds of this idea that the Pilgrims were the fathers of America. What really made it the story is that a publication mentioning that dinner, published by the Reverend Alexander Young, included a footnote that said, quote, "This was the first Thanksgiving, the great festival of New England," end quote. People picked up this footnote. The idea became pretty widely accepted, and Abraham Lincoln declared it a holiday during the Civil War to foster unity. It gained purchase in the late 19th century when there was an enormous amount of anxiety and agitation over immigration. The white Protestant stock of the United States was widely unhappy about the influx of European Catholics and Jews, and wanted to assert its cultural authority over these newcomers. How better to do that than to create this national founding myth around the Pilgrims and the Indians inviting them to take over the land? This myth-making was also impacted by the racial politics of the 19th century. The Indian Wars were coming to a close, and that was an opportune time to have Indians included in a national founding myth. You couldn't have done that when people were reading newspaper accounts on a regular basis of atrocious violence between white Americans and native people in the West. What's more, during Reconstruction, that Thanksgiving myth allowed New Englanders to create this idea that bloodless colonialism in the region was the origin of the country, having nothing to do with the Indian Wars and slavery. Americans could feel good about their colonial past without having to confront the really dark characteristics of it. Can you explain the discrepancies in English and Wampanoag conceptions of property? It's incorrect, as is widely assumed, that native people had no sense of property. They didn't have private property, but they had community property, and they certainly understood where their people's land started and where it ended. And so, when Europeans came to the Americas, and they buy land from the Wampanoags initially assume the English are buying into Wampanoag country, not that they're buying Wampanoag country out from under their feet. Imagine a flotilla of Wampanoag canoes across the Atlantic and goes to England, and then the Wampanoags buy land from the English there. Has that land now passed out of the jurisdiction of England to become the Wampanoags? No, that's ridiculous. But that's precisely what the English were assuming on this side of the Atlantic. Part of what King Philip's War was about is Wampanoag people saying, "Enough, you're not going to turn us into a landless, subjugated people." Did all Wampanoags want to enter into alliance with the English? From the very beginning, a sizable number of Wampanoags disagreed with Usamequin's decision to reach out to the English and tried to undermine the alliance. Usamequin puts down multiple plots to wipe out the colony and unseat him. Some Wampanoags say, quote, "Let's make an alliance with the Narragansetts and get rid of these English. They've been raiding our coasts for decades, enslaving our people, carrying them off to unknown fates. They can't be trusted," end quote. Some Wampanoags believe that they caused the epidemics and there were prophecies that this would be the end of the people. When the English arrived, they entered a multilateral Indian political world in which the internal politics of the Wampanoag tribe and the intertribal politics of the Wampanoag tribe were paramount. To the degree the Wampanoags dealt with the English, it was to adjust the power dynamics of Indian country. You write that during King Philip's War, efforts to unify different tribes against the settlers weren't always successful. Why was that? The politics of Indian country are more important to native people than their differences with colonists. There were no Indians when the English arrived. Native people didn't conceive of themselves as Indians. That's an identity that they have had to learn through their shared struggles with colleagues. And it takes a long time. They have been here for 12,000 plus years. And there are a lot of differences between them. Their focus is on their own people, not on the shared interests of Indians, and very often what's in the best interest of their own people is cutting deals with colonial powers with an eye towards combating their native rivals. How does your telling of these events differ from other existing scholarship? The main difference has to do with King Philip's War. The question is whether native people led by Metacomet, or Philip as the English call him, were plotting a multi-tribal uprising against the English. I think they were. Some of my historian colleagues think it's a figment of paranoid English imagination, but I see a lot of warning signals building during the 1660s and 70s from Englishmen who lived cheek by jowl with the Wampanoag people and were terrified of what they were seeing on the ground. I see a pattern of political meetings between native leaders who hated each other, and yet they were getting together over and over and over again. It all adds up to me. There's this tendency to see the English as the devils in all of this. I don't think there's any question that they're in the wrong. But it doesn't let them off the hook to say that native people wouldn't take it anymore. And regardless of that, I think the evidence shows that native people had reached their limit and recognized that if they didn't rise up immediately, they were going to become landless subordinates to English authority. This is about as contrary to the Thanksgiving myth that one can get. That's the story we should be teaching our kids. They should be learning about why native people reached that point, rather than this nonsense that native people willingly handed off their country to the invaders. It does damage to how our native countrymen and women feel as a part of this country. It makes white Americans a lot less reflective about where their privilege comes from, and it makes us a lot less critical as a country when it comes to interrogating the rationales that leaders will marshal to act aggressively against foreign others. If we're taught to cut through colonial rhetoric, we'll be better positioned to cut through modern colonial and empirical rhetoric. Claire Bugos, a journalist and former print intern at the Smithsonian Magazine, graduate of Northwestern University. Now, of course, I'll have a link back to this article, but as an interesting aside, it's helpful to know where some of that background on political ideology had come from within that first Thanksgiving. Another piece that came from the Reader's Digest talked about, in their article on the first Thanksgiving, under the heading of "When Was the First Thanksgiving?" It says, "The Pilgrims may have celebrated in 1620, but that wasn't actually Thanksgiving. So when was the first Thanksgiving?" That occurred in the fall of 1621 in what is now Massachusetts, but here's a piece of Thanksgiving trivia. It didn't become well known until Bradford's Journal was discovered and published by Sarah Josepha Hale, a magazine editor in the early 1800s. Hale was so taken with the story of that first Thanksgiving that she lobbied five U.S. presidents to make it a federal holiday. In 1863, President Abraham Lincoln finally declared Thanksgiving the U.S. holiday, an act he saw as a step toward reuniting the fractured country after the Civil War. He put it on the calendar for the last Thursday of November. In December 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt changed Thanksgiving to the fourth Thursday in November to avoid confusion in years where there is a fifth Thursday in November. He also reasoned that this change slightly lengthened the holiday season, which was good for the economy. Considering Black Friday is nearly a holiday in and of itself, it's safe to say he was right. Another section of this article is entitled, Why is the Thanksgiving Story Controversial? What's the harm in believing the happy version so many of us grew up with? It's just a story, right? This is what they call whitewashing, and it downplays the long and bloody series of conflicts between white settlers and Native Americans that would occur over the next two centuries. Narratives of a harmonious Thanksgiving celebration were created to justify westward expansion and manifest destiny. The term manifest destiny, coined more than two centuries after the first Thanksgiving, was the belief that settlers were destined by God to expand across America and prosper. The simple story also perpetrates myths that still harm Native Americans today, says Raymond Foxworth, Ph.D., a citizen of the Navajo Nation. And then it goes on to give us a couple of myths about Thanksgiving history that we need to stop believing. And they go on like this. Myth: the first Thanksgiving started the tradition that founded the holiday. In truth, the harvest celebration of 1621 was not called Thanksgiving and was not repeated every year. The next official day of Thanksgiving was after settlers massacred more than 400 Pequot men, women, and children. Governor Bradford's journal decreed for the next 100 years every Thanksgiving day ordained by a governor is in honor of the bloody victory, thanking God that the battle had been won. We should add that to our list of favorite Thanksgiving quotes as a stark reminder of the real history of Thanksgiving. The myth: pilgrims and Native Americans were friends who worked together. Truth: this was true in some limited conditions, like the diplomatic treaty of protection. But more often, the settlers took what they wanted while tens of thousands of Native Americans died of diseases brought by the colonizers, sometimes intentionally, and more were captured and sold into slavery. Even Squanto, famous for translating and teaching the settlers how to farm native crops, learned those skills out of necessity after being kidnapped as a child and sold into slavery in Spain. He returned to Cape Cod to find that he was the only surviving member of his tribe. Myth: the pilgrims taught the uncivilized Indians about Thanksgiving. Truth: many people still have a picture of Native Americans living in dirt and squalor until the European settlers enlightened them. Nothing could be further from the truth. Native Americans had large and complex societies long before settlers arrived. They already had established harvest celebrations, feast traditions, and holidays of their own. They were also well aware of the virtue of gratitude and had their own religious beliefs and rituals. So, how can we help? Reader's Digest says, once we understand the complicated real history of Thanksgiving, there are things we can do to celebrate the holiday in a meaningful way while respecting and honoring our Native Americans. We can also make new traditions with our loved ones. We can share the truth. We can talk to our kids and other loved ones about the real history of Thanksgiving, correct the myths when we hear them, and have open discussions in public places like schools. We can also share this video made by Native Americans about reclaiming Native truth. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. We can avoid stereotypes in decorations and crafts. We need to be aware of how we represent Native Americans in crafts, media, and Thanksgiving table settings. For example, in some schools, students may make Thanksgiving crafts like headbands using feathers. But in many Native American cultures, feathers are highly religious articles, and presenting sacred activities in trivial ways can be highly offensive and disrespectful, even if it seems perfectly innocent. We can donate to organizations led and controlled by Native Americans. Donating money can go a long way towards helping, but not all charities are created equal. The First Nations Development Institute has compiled a list of hundreds of community partners that are working in Native American food sovereignty, language preservation, youth programs, community building, and asset building. And lastly, we can learn more. We can read books, both for ourselves and with our kids, that portray Native Americans and American history in an accurate way. We can seek out books by Native authors, talk to Native Americans, and learn about culture and how they celebrate Thanksgiving. We can choose a book to share with our family on Thanksgiving. I'll have links to both the Reader's Digest and, of course, the Smithsonian piece in the show notes. I'll put a link in the show notes also to the video that they had suggested on the Reader's Digest page. But I found this to be just a really interesting and succinct look at something that we do every single year. As we reflect on these kind of things during the FDR's economical season, we tend to just not want to think about this stuff because it's like, oh yeah, That's all great. Let's think about that stuff later. Let's live in the moment right now. Let's be grateful and thankful for what we have. And we've changed it, and we don't have to know all this other stuff. Like, we know it was bad. That's enough. Is it enough? I feel like maybe we should actually know some things. And perhaps through some of what presented here, that these articles have presented in the past, that we can at least come to an agreement that we have an objective look that if we didn't have before, I hope we've inspired you to look a little bit deeper. This is not a war on quote-unquote traditional Thanksgiving or anything of that nature. I really hope that I don't get any weird emails like that that come through, but I'm sure I will. But all I'm really trying to do is call attention to the real facts here. And I hope that we can remember this time in the American history as a time of, you know, maybe something that we shouldn't be celebrating exactly what this is. We should celebrate it a different way. We can bring about new kinds of thinking on these issues. When I was initially reading the article, and one of the parts of it talked about how using craft store headbands and feathers and a headdress could be considered inappropriate, I thought, well, what is something that perhaps, you know, what is something that perhaps a Christian person might find as offensive in doing something along those lines, perhaps in a school or what have you? And while I really couldn't think of one offhand, I was reminded of a time when I replied to a brother on a public forum on Facebook, and I abbreviated Christmas as Xmas. And this brother really took offense to that I was belittling the holiday and that I was being offensive. And I didn't know that that was offensive to some Christians to hyphenate or to, you know, X-M-A-S, to write Xmas out like that. And so I stopped doing it because I now knew, right? In that same vein, I think that there is often a perspective that we're lacking and we just don't know until we do know, right? And so rather than being, you know, contrary or being sour about the situation, I simply took it as a learning experience. I said, oh, I didn't know that. I won't do that anymore, and I don't. I suppose that's really the call here, is that regardless of the culture, truth matters. And the Freemason is always in search of truth, and I hope that we've given a more objective look. If you all are looking for some really cool objective books on U.S. history, I do have to say, I think David McCullough, who wrote books like 1776, I think he wrote John Adams too, he writes a really great objective history in his books. It's not about, you know, darn those colonialists or war against the English. You know, it's really an equitable look at things on both sides and how the feelings were on both ends of the spectrum. So I do recommend those. All right, this week I want to go ahead and do another tarot card draw. So I'm going to pick a deck right now. All right, this is going to be a fun one. I'm going to draw a card from a questionable source. Most weeks I do a tarot card draw where we grab a random themed tarot deck, we pull one card, and we look at what that card could mean as it is prescribed and how that might work for us in Freemasonry. Kind of like a Rorschach. We pull the card, we read its meaning, and we say, how does that fit into our lives today? Could it mean this? Could it mean that? How could we perceive it in a Masonic way? Much like we would use a Masonic working tool. If I all of a sudden pulled the Masonic tarot card that was the 24-inch gauge, how is that working for me right now? And I started thinking like, well, I've been really busy. What am I neglecting? Right? So in that same way, we get a little bit serious and contemplative. This year, being right before Thanksgiving, we're going to be doing some feasting, some gathering, some giving thanks of what we have, and remembering and holding up truth. And so while we had a serious moment throughout this episode, let's lighten it up a little bit. I'm going to be pulling from a special deck, a 30-card tarot deck called The Tarot of Cocktails, The Mystic Drinks from the Tarot. Let's check it out. So the white book that comes with this deck is actually a small recipe book that allows you to write in your impressions and your appraisals of how delicious or not delicious the drink was. Let's go ahead, shuffle, and pick out a drink. And my commitment to this particular deck, or to this particular tarot card draw, is that I will make this drink, and I'll put it on TikTok as I make it, and I will drink it. Give it a live review. We'll see how it goes. I'm a little bit scared. I just hope I don't have to buy some, like, exclusive, rare, alcoholic beverage for this kind of thing. I'm not a millionaire, you know? Watch, I'm gonna draw a card and it's gonna call for, like, Louis or something. I don't have $1,500 for a bottle. But if I had a bottle, I'd share it with all of you. Alright. What are we gonna draw? I'm gonna kinda shuffle them up here. And I got the Break of Dawn. I'll post a picture of the card and the recipe in the Craftsman's Plus Facebook group. It's labeled as card 18. Break of Dawn. Ingredients says salt and black pepper for the rim, tomato juice, vodka, beet juice, carrot juice, Tabasco. Oh, this sounds terrible. You know what? I'm not doing it. I'm not going to make this. This sounds disgusting. I'm picking a different drink. I'm doing it right now. You guys can laugh all you want. I'm not going to drink that. I don't like Bloody Marys. That just sounds like a funky Bloody Mary. Anyway, let's see. It would be really great if I picked a non-alcoholic drink out of here, I think. Let's see. All right. This sounds like I could do it. The Flower of Palms. Card number 28. Okay, so I went up 10 suits. I'll put both of these in the show notes. But the Flower of Palms says water, light rum, unsweetened coconut cream? Where am I going to get that? Lemon juice, cinnamon syrup? What? Rose water? Man, I'm going to have to go shopping for this one drink. Okay, anyway, combine all ingredients in a blender without ice. Shake mixture. Strain into a low ball filled with ice. Garnish with rose petals and sprinkle of cinnamon. You know, I don't think I'm going to put the rose petals in there. I'll do the cinnamon probably, but gee whiz. All right, what's it say? It says, see page 63 of the companion book, which I have right here. I'll tell you right now, my impressions are going to be convoluted. No, I'm just kidding. It says, this creamy coconut and fresh citrus in Flower of Palms recall Brazilian lemonade, while the rose water and cinnamon evoke ambrosial desserts like baklava. Okay. Well, I'll try it out. I'm going to try to get this done, you know, before Thanksgiving. So give me a follow at the Wizard of Arge on TikTok, and I'll see if I can make this super funky cocktail. Anyway, you probably got all excited for a really cool episode of Tarot Draw, but maybe this made you laugh, and maybe we could try this together. We'll do like a repost. You make it next. All right. Well, that's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. I hope you do have a thoughtful Thanksgiving and that you think about everyone in your life who is making your life easier, better, somehow stronger, that you don't take for granted all of those, what we call those material surroundings, those manifold blessings that surround us. This time of year, especially, it's just that time of year to do these things. It's just what we've kind of done in society. And as I say every year around this time of year, I really hope we take this attitude of gratitude and we push it through so that it lasts all year long. One last time, I want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the program. If you would like to learn more about how you can help produce the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com. Click on Support the Show and see your options there. That's it. I'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
That's it. Hey, girl.